welcome back to the program. For many of us, we have powerful and painful memories of high school and middle school. Sometimes, if we were not the most popular kid, then probably something happened that we still remember today as if it happened yesterday. The scar tissue of those years is even tougher if we were the victims of bullying. And for others, it may be the guilt of being the one doing the bullying or of not standing up for our friends. Now, Emily Bazelon takes a look at the meaning and culture of bullying and how it affects kids today. Emily Bazelon is a senior editor at Slate, a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine, and the Truman Capote Fellow for Creative Writing and Law at Yale Law School. It is my pleasure to welcome Emily Bazelon here to talk about Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily Bazelon, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Great to have you here. To what extent, as you began to look at this, is the bullying that we see in schools today, particularly in middle schools and high schools, as you write about it, reflective of broader trends in society in terms of more aggression and greater bullying that goes on everywhere from what happens in the streets to what happens on talk radio?
Well, it's really hard to draw a straight line of cause and effect here, but I think you're on to something. I mean, kids see a lot of strutting and posing and very aggressive talk and behavior on TV, on social media, all the time. And adults, they see adults getting attention for that. And it just seems inevitable that that would start seeping into their interactions as well.
As you talk about it with respect to kids, how do we define bullying today? There's certainly a fine line sometimes between aggressive behavior, meanness, and real bullying.
Right. You're absolutely right. And I think this is actually crucial to think about. The proper definition of bullying is physical or verbal abuse that is repeated over time and involves a power imbalance. So we're really talking about one kid or a group of kids lording it over another kid to make him miserable. And I think the reason that's so important is that when we limit the definition, you can see that this is really bad behavior. And it's behavior that has associated with short-term and long-term psychological harm. So this is really something we should try to prevent. And we can. It's not something most kids do. Whereas if you expand the definition of bullying to include all teasing or every fight, then it seems like, okay, you know, kids have to have some room to learn how to be aggressive and to manage conflict. And it also seems like, how could we ever address this problem? It's just too big.
And what is that power imbalance usually about when we look at it with respect to kids? Is it about popularity? Is there economic consideration? What creates that power imbalance among the kids?
It's often about popularity. You know, one thing to remember about teenagers is many aspects of their lives are controlled by adults, but one thing they can control is their assessment of each other and their definitions and assessments of status. And often adults can't even see the distinctions among kids, but everyone remembers from middle school and high school who the popular kids were and who the kids were who had a lot of power. So I think often with bullying, we see the kids enforce those distinctions, and then there are also a particular vulnerable groups. Gay kids are still much more likely to get harassed and bullied in high school, unfortunately, and that can be true also for kids who are a religious minority at a school, and then particularly for disabled kids.
It's essentially any kid that stands out. What it creates in so many cases is a desire on the part of kids to blend in, to be almost invisible.
Exactly. And, you know, kids are always balancing this fine line between wanting some attention and being nervous about being too different than the group. And so one of the things that bullying does is kind of single out some kids who are vulnerable and who are on the edge for some reason and really, you know, make them suffer for that.
With respect to the kids that are walking that fine line, what about the ones that are both the ones that are bullied and that also engage in bullying?
Well, that's a really important group. I'm so glad you brought up those kids. They're called bully victims. And they, you're right, they lash out sometimes, but they also can be persecuted. And what we see with those kids is they tend to have the biggest psychological problems. They're kids who are just really struggling socially. And often they end up doing the dirty work for kids who are the more like manipulative queen bee types. So I think for these bully victims, their behavior, while it's hard to deal with, is really a cry for help.
What is the difference we see in terms of bullying between girls and boys?
boys still bully more than girls. They tend to bully other boys and girls, whereas girls really only usually tend to bully other girls. But we're very focused right now culturally on mean girls. And I think the reason for that is that girls often use friendship. They turn on friends when they become bullies, and that can be very devastating.
And one of the things we see is that alliances among these kids change all the time. That the kid that's being bullied today can be bullying someone else with a different group tomorrow.
Right. Well, that's true that social status is very fluid among teenagers, and I think this can be tricky for adults because sometimes they don't realize which kids are the vulnerable kids. And I think sometimes kids also make this mistake. In my book, I talk about the difference between a rivalry where you have kids of pretty equal social status and bullying where you have a much weaker kid. And I think sometimes the kids themselves don't realize that they're being bullies because they think of someone as a rival who in fact is really not.
All of this nuance makes it much more difficult for the parents to navigate and understand, even without the technological component, which we'll talk about, but just in terms of understanding the dynamics of the schoolyard, it gets complicated.
That's true. And, you know, parents need to really listen to their kids and make sure they have all the facts and understand what's going on. You know, sometimes parents can be overprotective and call bullying, so to speak, when that's not exactly what's happening. And the problem with that is then you can lose credibility. If you make an accusation and it turns out there isn't really evidence to support it, it can be harder to get your kid the help she actually needs.
And it's hard sometimes to really get to the bottom of what's going on, as in the story of Phoebe Prince and what happened in South Hadley.
Well, that's true. I mean, this was one of the first cases of what was termed a bully side. Phoebe Prince was a 15-year-old girl who committed suicide in South Hadley, Massachusetts. And in the wake of her death, prosecutors brought serious criminal charges against six kids, effectively blaming them for bullying her to death. You know, in fact, there was a very complicated set of circumstances going on. It's certainly true that bullying was a contributing factor, but Phoebe Prince was also a vulnerable kid. She had a history of depression and cutting and attempted suicide, and so while it's a very sad story, it's not the simple black and white narrative that the prosecutors told.
And of course, what all of this raises is the degree to which so many kids that may not be the one doing the bullying stand by and watch what's going on. They're the bystanders.
Right, and it's so important to talk about the power of the bystanders. Bullying almost always takes place in front of an audience of peers, but we know from studies that kids only step in about 20% of the time. When they do step in, however, they can stop the bullying half the time. So you can see that they're an important part of the puzzle. And then the next question is, okay, so why don't they step up more? And I think that is also complicated, but it's one thing that's really important to remember is it's hard to confront a bully. How many adults stand up to people who are being really aggressive and dominating? It's a very tricky thing to do. I learned this myself in working on my book. And so one of the things I feel strongly is it's important to give kids a variety of strategies. If you are a powerful kid yourself and you have it in you to confront a bully, by all means, step up. But if that's too much to ask sometimes, you can also do a lot of good with a much smaller gesture. Just by asking someone if they're okay after the fact or sending a sympathetic text message, when kids who are bullied are asked what their peers did that helped the most, it's those small moments of empathy that they name.
It's that if they can't stand up to the bully, they can at least stand with the victim, essentially.
Exactly. That's exactly how I put it.
Talk a little bit about what technology has done to all of this. It used to be that if you had fights in the schoolyard or fights at school or these battles that went on, even some of the most aggressive, you could get home and be away from it. Now there's no escape.
That's exactly right. And kids who are having trouble in school with their peers often feel like the same people are going to be gossiping about them online. And that means that you don't have a respite after school. And also sometimes kids get drawn into responding online, and that usually just creates a vicious cycle. So that's one way in which the internet has really changed this experience. And the other thing to think about is the point of view of the kid who's bullying. Instead of being face-to-face with another child and really seeing the impact you're having, it's, you can write things that are very harsh online without having to really confront the consequences in an immediate way. And you can also do it anonymously on some social media sites, which gives kids leeway, and adults too, to say things they would never say in person. And then finally, we have this problem of impulsivity. You know, we have all, I think, sent an email, push send, without really thinking it through. And we know that for teenagers, this really hits them in a neurological weak spot. The part of their brains that is less developed is the part that deals with impulse control.
There's also empathy. I want to talk about that and how these kids, particularly at 12, 13, 14 years old, develop empathy and how they see that as part of their whole psychological makeup.
Right. So I think empathy really starts at home. I mean, it's as simple as around the dinner table asking kids to think about what it feels like to be someone else and to value those feelings. I use books a lot in my house to do this, and I have some resources in my book suggesting strategies and literature that parents can use. It's so important to remember that almost everybody has the capacity for empathy, and we really need to build up this skill in kids by teaching them that it's a value to us. So, you know, one of the questions I ask myself is, am I just as excited if one of my sons comes home and tells me that they've done something kind or stood up for someone as I am when they come home if they have a good report card?
One of the things you talk about is that there's only a limited number of things that schools can do, and that we often look to schools to do too much to deal with these issues.
I think that's true. You know, schools that are trying to do their best by kids have taken on a lot of these questions of moral development and character and teaching empathy because they know that they essentially are raising their kids along with us. And I respect that choice they're making. I do think, though, we have not really had a full national conversation about what we're demanding from schools and whether they have the resources to do this right.
What should the schools be doing? What is the appropriate level of either intervention or even education as it relates to empathy and emotional development?
Well, schools can play a really important role here. Part of what is crucial is creating a social norm in which bullying is not acceptable. So that's not just up to the school. Parents and the community have a role to play here, too. But one strategy that's really been shown to be effective is when schools do internal surveys about bullying. What they find is that most kids don't bully, and most kids don't like bullying. And then when they send that message out to kids, for example, they can put up posters saying, you know, 90% of the kids at this school don't deliberately exclude other kids. Then they find that the rate of bullying goes down even further as the kids report it, because what happens is kids see this as an outlier behavior, and that makes them less likely to do it.
And parents today don't necessarily know how to deal with it either, even those helicopter parents that are overly involved.
Right. This is very tricky, that line between making sure that you're being an advocate for your child and not hovering so much that you don't give them any chance to develop their own skills for managing conflict. So one thing that I suggest to parents is if their kids are coming to them, you know, because they say they're being bullied or they're worried about another kid, or maybe they're, you know, being too aggressive themselves and parents have a sense that their kid is turning into a bully. In all of those circumstances, you can sit down with your kid and ask your kid what his strategies are to try to get your kid to come up with a good solution to the problem rather than just directing him. I mean, you know, sometimes, especially if you have a kid who's a bully, they're going to need some real push from you. But often the best problem solving for kids is what they help come up with themselves, because that's how you become resilient. That's how you learn how to deal with adversity in life. You learn that when you work on something and you think through it, things get better.
How difficult is it for parents of kids that are bullies to acknowledge that, to come to accept that in their kid, and then begin to deal with it?
Well, I think you're right. This is hard. You know, in our culture of parenting right now, it is hard for us to believe anything ill of our kids. And we sometimes tend in a knee-jerk way to defend our own children instead of having a more old-fashioned approach where when the community is telling you that your kid is doing something wrong, it's up to you to take your kid in hand and make sure they grow up to be the moral person you want them to be. So I do think you're right that parents of kids who are being accused of bullying need to really think about whether there is something to that accusation and not just defend their kids without really having good reason to.
Is there any evidence that, that bullying at home, that bullying behavior on the part of parents, even if it's not directed towards the kids, directed to others, in some way sets the stage for what the kid then does with respect to his or her peers?
Yes, there is definitely a link between kids who bully, and especially kids who are both bullies and victims, and domestic violence or child abuse or even what's called sibling abuse, having brothers or sisters who really come down hard on you. So, you know, that is an important consideration, that sometimes when kids are lashing out at school, they're basically reflecting the behavior they see at home.
Many of the kids that you talk about, the three or four that, that you focus on, are essentially middle school kids, 12, 13, 14. Is that the kind of sweet spot for this bullying problem?
Yes, that's when we see the rate of bullying become the highest. Even in high school, kids have sort of, you know, they're a little more mature. In good high schools, there's a sense that you can be a socially successful person in a lot of different ways rather than having this very rigid social hierarchy. And middle school is a time when kids are really fumbling and figuring out their own identity. And as I was saying before, their brains just aren't as developed in these aspects of impulse control, and they're most susceptible to peer pressure. So, yes, it is true that middle school is just a tricky time in life, and bullying is one of the things that kids that age tend to contend with.
The other aspect, and you talk about this with respect even to your own experience, is how long these scars stay with us, that these tend to be things that affect us for a long, long time.
Right. I mean, one of the reasons I wrote my book was when I started writing about bullying for Slate, the online magazine where I work, I found that everybody had a story about this. They remembered seeing, witnessing an incident of bullying that left a deep impression, or they had experienced it, and or some people remembered doing things they were really ashamed of. And I just thought, what is going on here? Why are these such foundational, transformative moments? And I think they really become embedded in our childhood memories and our developing sense of self. And then very recently, in the last couple of weeks, a study came out from Duke University in which kids who'd been bullied or who'd been bullies and victims 20 years later, when they were adults, still had strikingly higher rates of depression and anxiety disorders and suicidal thinking. And that, you know, that study really shows us that we are talking about something with long-term impact.
One of the things that's different, I want to come back to the whole issue of technology for a moment, because one of the other aspects, and maybe it's not clear yet what kind of impact it'll have over the long run, is bullying that goes on that's not face-to-face. At least, you know, when it's happening among kids in school or even outside of school, there's a face-to-face component. As soon as it goes online, there's something entirely different.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, kids sometimes try out these harsher personas online. The kids I reported on from my book taught me a word for this. They call it being a Facebook thug, where sometimes kids who would be, you know, relatively quiet in school turn into this sort of different persona. It's as if they're, like, imitating someone on a reality television show.
You mentioned that you went to Facebook and actually talked to them about what they're doing about bullying that goes on.
Yeah, that's right. I spent a day at Facebook with their, it's called the Hate and Harassment Team, and they're the people who are dealing with complaints about bullying. Facebook gets about 2 million complaints a week. They're not all about bullying, but a lot of them are, and the challenge is that the company has a relatively small number of people working on this, so they are very, very quickly, I'm talking about a second or two, going through these complaints. So one of the tips I got out of this visit was that if you report bullying yourself as a kid, as opposed to having your parent do it for you on Facebook, they will take your word for it. You know, I also came out of my visit thinking that Facebook could do a lot more to work with schools to really help schools deal with this problem. And I think as a company, they are not interested in aligning with the kind of uncool authority figure, but that's really disappointing because there's a lot here that that they could do that they're really not doing yet.
Are we seeing a real increase in the amount of bullying, or are we just more aware of it and talking about it more?
We are just more aware of it and talking about it more. You know, this actually was really surprising to me because there's so much talk of an epidemic. But in fact, over several countries over the last 25 years, the rates of bullying have really not risen. It's really our awareness of the problem that has changed.
And is it different in other countries and other cultures? Are there fundamental differences, or is there some universality to what we're talking about?
There is some universality. It's actually interesting. This particular pattern of childhood behavior really cuts across cultures. It also cuts across class. It's one issue in which middle class and poor and wealthy parents and families just have a lot in common.
Emily Bazelon, her book is Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Emily, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you for your great questions.
Thank you.